This is a Crestview Bible podcast. For more information, visit crestviewhutch.org.
In the 90s, when I was in high school and college, I remember a song that I heard over and over again on Christian radio. And here's what it asked. What if we fall into the bottom of a well, thinking we've risen to the top of the mountain? What if we're knocking at the gates of hell, thinking that we're heaven bound? What if we spend our lives thinking of ourselves when we should have been thinking of each other? And what if we reach up and touch the ground and find that we're living life upside down? So, the big question, I think, that's at play in the book of Ecclesiastes is how you're living. Do you feel an emptiness to your life in the here and now? What does life feel like? All the stuff that you're giving yourself to pursue, what is the impact of that? And so we're beginning with this book today. Typically, the nation of Israel reads this book when they're celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Booths, so this is a joyful pursuit. The message of Ecclesiastes sometimes feels really strange. If you read through this, and by the way, I would encourage you to read it. If you read two chapters a day starting tomorrow, you'd be done by next Sunday. So you'd finish on Saturday and be ready, kind of have a layout of the book. That's what I've been doing for a while, just reading a couple chapters a day. You could do that easily starting tomorrow. Read chapters 1 and 2 and then keep going through the week. It's a joyful thing to pursue that. And as we open the book here, we're immediately introduced to some questions and themes, just like I talked about in that opening paragraph about how, what if we find that we're living life upside down? What is life about? What is life meant to be? These are the same themes that we get to. And if you look in verse 1 there, we see that these are the words of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem. So we're told in this opening verse that these are the words of the preacher. The Hebrew word for that is Kohelet. And the reason I'm telling you that is sometimes when you're reading books that talk about Ecclesiastes, they'll mention that word, Kohelet, Q-O-H-E-L-E-T, Kohelet. That's the word that's translated there, the preacher. And it's kind of someone who would gather sayings. The preacher has gathered all these words together to try to leave a message in our lives. That's why it's called the preacher. There's something communicated here. And we're told this preacher is the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And more than likely, this is referring to Solomon. And the rest of the book is going to show this, that Solomon was uniquely qualified to make some of these investigations. So we need to know these things as we begin to dig in. We don't want to be found to be living life upside down. Now, in researching to prep for this book, I came across, I talked to a lot of scholars and did a lot of reading, and there are a lot of statements written about the importance of reading the book of Ecclesiastes, but what was most helpful was Ray Ortland's Twitter feed. So Ray Ortland pastors in a church in Nashville, Tennessee called Emmanuel, and here's some of what he tweeted out about the book of Ecclesiastes. So I'm going to read you a few of these. You will not live long, but you can live well. You'll soon die and be forgotten with no lasting mark on this world. But in it all, God will be present, showering joyous gifts upon you in the simple experiences of daily life. Enjoy and get ready to meet him. That's what he's saying the book of Ecclesiastes is about. Or he says this, if you've been defeated by life, you can't see what's the point, you feel like giving up, good. You're finally ready for the wisdom of Ecclesiastes. Our options in the book of Ecclesiastes. Number 1, create your own meaning and permanence and be crushed by reality. Or 2, let God give us everything worth having and enjoy the ride. According to Ecclesiastes, 2 things stand out. 1, life is crazy. 2, God is involved. Wisdom is not mastering that, but accepting it. He says, another reason I love Ecclesiastes is that it isn't religious. There's no flowery evasions, no pious negativity. I hate religion. I love life. The book of Ecclesiastes proves that it's possible to be disgusted and disillusioned with this world and still trust God and enjoy life. If you want to understand what's happening in this world, everywhere you look, absolutely everywhere, you'll find it in Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes shows that what makes our lives worthwhile is not our impact on the world, which is fleeting, but our origin in God, who is good. So these are just a sampling. I mean, I think there's, I have 6 pages single-spaced of Ray Ortland's tweets in Ecclesiastes, so it's pretty awesome. But that's just a flavor. This is what I'm hoping we can grasp as we kind of hear the heartbeat of this book and begin to digest it into our lives. There's a realistic view of life given in the book of Ecclesiastes. This maybe makes it unique in the Bible. And specifically, we see this unfold in verse 2. So look at Ecclesiastes 1:2. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. So any guesses as to what the big theme is? So there in that verse, how many times is vanity mentioned? Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. That's 7. That's a lot of times in a single verse to mention one word. This word vanity is really the key to understanding this book. That's maybe the most important theme. If you stuck your finger in chapter 1 and went all the way to chapter 12, which is where the book ends, in chapter 12, verse 8, at the end of the book, here's what we read. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. So it's almost like he's trying to sandwich all this together to give us one message that points to that. It brackets what this book is about. So what is the word vanity? And the Hebrew word there, again, I'm telling you this is just because you might do a reading or you might see something in your notes and you might see this word H-E-B-E-L. That's how you would transcribe this. It's in Hebrew, it's hevel. You can't pronounce it with a B. The B and the V are the same in Hebrew, and you just put a dot to tell you which one's different. But hevel. And the word literally means a breath or a vapor. Hevel. It's just, huh. That's what vanity means. Scholars love to discuss this word's meaning. I mean, there were a lot of pages written about what hevel means, what vanity means. And the most imaginative and maybe the most helpful came from Fred Brock. I think this will resonate with all of you. So this is so good. And here's how he paraphrases verse 2. Soap bubbles of soap bubbles, says the preacher. Soap bubbles of soap bubbles, all is soap bubbles. Okay, so you got the image in your mind? Have you ever noticed that there's a beauty to a soap bubble? I know some of us guys don't hang out in the kitchen a lot, but maybe if you don't do the dishes, which you should serve your wife and do the dishes occasionally. But sometimes if she's doing the dishes or you're doing the dishes, you'll see a soap bubble somehow escape the tepid pond of dishwater. And that soap bubble will be floating up in the air, and it has all these colors swirling around it. If you looked at that for a moment, you would see purple hues and just the amazing colors hitting that. And then pop, and it's gone. And you're thinking, well, that was like worthless. That was meaningless. What's the big deal about soap bubbles? That's exactly the point that the writer's trying to make. There's a beauty to this with translucent colorings floating away, but when it pops, when that soap bubble pops, it's empty. It disappoints expectations. It fails to achieve the purpose it was meant for. It's utterly senseless. And so 38 times in the book of Ecclesiastes, you're going to come across this word, this concept of vanity. And so it's important for you to be thinking about it. And when you do, just think soap bubbles. Think soap bubbles. Think of just something that's there that's meant to have a purpose, and then it's just gone. And it's empty. It's vanity. The sphere of exploring all this emptiness, the vanity of life, comes in verse 3. What does a man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? So this is maybe the question of the book. Where vanity is the theme, the question is verse 3. What's really being answered in this book is that question in verse 3. What advantage is there, or what profit is there, or what gain is there for human toil? We'll come back to this in 2:11 and 3:9 and 5:15. 22 times in this book. This concept of toil and trying to understand and make sense of what's going on with the toil we do in this world is going to be explored. And it's explored under the perspective of being under the sun. It's an earthly perspective. So do you see that at the end of verse 3? What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? Under the sun. So I'm saying these things because as you're reading through maybe this week, circle every time under the sun is mentioned. Circle every time there's vanity. Circle every time toil comes up. Under the sun is huge because it's thinking about what's happening in this world. There's an above the sun reality. That would be heaven where God is. But the writer of Ecclesiastes, the preacher here, is giving us, helping us understand what's going on in this world under the sun, this physical world. It's here under the sun. 29 times in the book is this phrase under the sun used. So the author's so much bent on this so much that at times people writing about the book of Ecclesiastes wonder, do you even know that there's a God who lives above the sun? And he does. I mean, that's going to pop out at times. But he's really helping us understand and to see just the emptiness, the vanity of life under the sun. And that's going to be the predominant focus that we're going to have, the perspective we need to be having on earth. So, there's a graphic that we've created for our study of Ecclesiastes. I don't know if you can see it here. There's a copy in your notes as well with a theme. So the theme of the book that we're going to come back to time and again is the joy of fearing God under the sun. And that's not, I'm not going all clever on you with under the sun, S-O-N, but under the S-U-N, sun. And so you can see the graphic has like a wilted flower because there's an emptiness. It's like a vapor. It's just not delivering. It's not fulfilling its intended purpose. There's something empty about life under the sun, but there is a joy that we have when we fear God under the sun. So that's our big theme. Fearing God is where it all ends. Okay, for weeks here, we're going to be laboring to get to the end of the book. And then the end of the book is going to happen, and you're going to be like, couldn't he just have said that? Couldn't he just have said, you know, fear God and keep his commandments, this is the whole duty of man? Like, couldn't he have said that in chapter 1? Yeah, he could have, but we might not have felt that in the same way. So we need these 12 chapters to dig in deep into our life under the sun, to our toil, to all that we're doing in this life, to expose that for what it is, and so that we can live lives that do have value and purpose. So right there in your notes, right out of the gate, there's a rough outline there. You see that there's a prologue, that's verse 1-1. There's an epilogue, that's in chapter 12, verses 9 through 14. There's queries or questions that the writer is going to ask throughout the book. In 1-2, and where it says all is hevel there, think all is vanity. So that's why I wanted you to have that word in your vocabulary. All is vanity. And that theme returns in chapter 12, verse 8. And in the middle of that, we have a poem that we're going to look at today that introduces the book. There's a poem that concludes the book. And then in the middle, basically two big runs of content, investigating life and making some conclusions about life. That's what the writer's doing. So this is an outline from Jason DeRushi. He teaches at Bethlehem Seminary up in Minneapolis, and I really like that simple chart of just encapsulating the book. So I hope that's helpful for you. So today we're going to turn to verses 4 through 11 specifically to answer that question of verse 3. What does a man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? What is the advantage or the gain from the work that we're currently doing in this world? Now, you might feel pretty fulfilled in the work that you do in this world. But do you ever feel the raw nature of the fall raising its head? And what I mean by that is, because of the fall, work isn't easy. Work is work. You know, the curse of Genesis 3, by the sweat of your brow, you know, work's going to be happening. So what do you make of this? What is it driving you to pursue? Why would the preacher open up the book this way? What do we need to learn? I mean, what's going on here? So you might be a student in the room, so maybe you're an elementary or a teenage student or a college student or your study, and you're just weary from schoolwork. It's like, all I do is study. I'm just weary of this. Or you may be a parent stuck in the routine of life. Or you're a worker trying to make the best of the humdrum of life. And this passage is driving us to look deeper into the meaning that we have to that. Your work was never meant to be ultimate. So how do we make sense of this? One writer kind of summarizes these opening verses in this way, that when a good thing is turned into a God thing, it becomes a bad thing. So when a good thing turns into a God thing, it becomes a bad thing. And so think about your work. Think about your schoolwork. Think about your life as a parent. Think about your all these responsibilities that pull at you, all the toil that you're doing under the sun. What's the advantage of that? Today, that's really where we're headed, to consider our toil and see two ways that our work on earth leaves us empty. It doesn't deliver. Two ways that our work on earth leaves us empty. So let me read all these verses as we've introduced everything now, and then we'll dig into this and be done for today. So Ecclesiastes 1, verses 1 through 11. Here's what we read there. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does a man gain by all the toil which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises, the sun goes down, and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes round to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man can't utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there's nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new. It's been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. So this is God's word. Thanks be to God. Two ways that our work on earth leaves us empty. Really two big themes here that are wrapped up in this opening poem. And the first theme, the first way that our work leaves us empty is our work's empty because we follow the pattern of creation. We follow the pattern of creation, and we see this in verses 4 through 7, and jump right into verse 4. We start to get some insight into what profit or advantage or gain man has by all the toil of which he toils under the sun. And verse 4 reminds us that there's a generation that goes and a generation that comes, but the earth remains forever. Some of you have experienced that in your work, actually. You've had someone who is above you retire and move on. And maybe there's a new crop of people coming in, and so you've had to go through training to how to relate to millennials or something. That a generation comes and a generation goes, but the earth remains forever. And what the writer's saying here at the start is our work is just like that. It follows the cycle of creation. And what's the cycle of creation? Well, the earth is permanent. So what can we expect? That there is some wisdom here for us in how the earth functions. It's always been here. No matter who's come or who's gone, it's remained. And yet the earth seems to move with some sort of sense of enigma, or there's a vanity to it, like it's empty. The earth is permanent, and yet it always operates the same way, right? So we're invited to consider the sun in verse 5. Look at the sun. It rises, it goes down, and then it hurries around to rise again. And then go down again. And then it hurries around to rise and go down again. I mean, that's... You might think, well, I really like watching sunrises. What's the writer here talking about? It's just saying that that's repetitive. You know, when we plainsmen of Kansas drive to Colorado for the weekend, we are awestruck, like, oh man, I can't believe people get to look at these mountains every day. Man, if I lived out here, it would be worship every day. And then if you've been on vacation there a week, you're like yelling at kids, and oh, I'm so sick of being here. I'm ready to be back home. And it's because creation doesn't deliver. It just is cyclical. It's always there. So the sun, it's gorgeous in the morning, and then there's evening, it's gorgeous. When that storm was rolling in Friday night, I was at a high school football game, they actually did a halftime fireworks show, and man, the storm was there, the sun was setting behind that, and it was casting this image, oh, it was gorgeous. But you know what? The sun's gonna come up again tomorrow. It's gonna set again. And then we're told about the wind. The wind blows to the south, and then goes around to the north. I mean, we've experienced this in the past week, right? Like we were, It was like 90 degrees, right? It's crazy. The wind blows to the south, it turns around to the north. Around and around it goes, and it returns on its circuit. So the wind was blowing from the south. When was that? Thursday? It was 90 degrees, 92 degrees. And then the wind turned from the north. And like again, I was actually sitting in at a high school football game, and the front was right on top of us. And it felt like someone just turned the AC on all of a sudden. And I was like, thank you, Lord. And then in the middle of it, like the wind died again and it came from the south. And I was like, who's hitting me with a blast of hot air? This is insane. And then it turned around and was freezing cold and nobody could stand it. And that's just how the wind does. The wind is going to keep doing its thing. There's going to be warmer days. There's going to be colder days. And it's going to keep going. That's what the writer's saying in verse 6. Or verse 7. All streams run to the sea. They run to the sea. But the sea never fills up. Like the ocean's never had enough. It's just always running there. So again, if we get all this rain, Cow Creek's going to be full. It's going to run to the Arkansas and run somewhere into Arkansas. And then run, you know, keep running and eventually end up in the ocean. And, you know, the ocean's not going to say, that's enough, I can't take anymore. The ocean's going to survive. So what this is helping us see, and you probably feel this already, is there's no sense of progress. There's no sense of forward movement for the earth. Whether it's the sun, the wind, the streams, there's a futility. There's a vanity to this world, this natural world. And if the world has always been around and it's permanent and it can't seem to have some sense of purpose, then what hope is there for you? That's what the writer's wanting you to feel. Man, if the world can't figure this out and the sun's just on this cycle, how am I supposed to walk into my workplace and be like, you know what, I have real purpose here. That's what we're to feel. Now, I know some of you are already working the answer in your mind, like, oh, I have purpose, and let me tell you why. You know, just hang on. This is the kind of what the writer's trying to get us to feel. Because we rush so quickly past these things, we don't even think about it. And we just immediately think, oh yeah, of course I have purpose. But man, I promise you, there's going to be a day in your job when you're going to wake up, and it might be, you know, you're waking up to get kids to school, or you're waking up to do something. It's almost like you're on autopilot. There's nothing purposeful about it. And you're just following the pattern of creation. There's an emptiness to that. And if you build your life on that, it's going to be vanity. It's fleeting. It's soap bubbles. What's going on with that? It's just popping and it's gone. So as you go through the routine of life and work, what's going to prove decisive for you? Well, the writer continues in verse 8, reminding us that all things are full of weariness, right? That's how verse 8 begins. All things are full of weariness. Yeah, we get it, yeah. And that secondly and finally, our work is empty because there's nothing new in our human world. There's nothing new. Not only does creation have a weariness, a never-ending sense of disappointing expectations, but our lives have this sense of weariness to them. We have a hard time talking about it. We have a hard time, that's what he's saying in verse 8, right? A man cannot utter it. Just the emptiness that we feel when the raw edges of life raise their head in our lives. We just don't really know what to say. The words escape us. Like, it just feels so empty. Or our eyes aren't satisfied. We think, well, if I can just look at something else, if I can see something, if I could read another book, or if I could use my eyes to do something, I could make a real difference in the world. And the eyes are never satisfied. And our ears can never hear enough. Oh, maybe I just need to have another conversation. Maybe I just need to, if I could just do this. We gobble up more and more and more, and the treadmill of life, much like this world, is going to go on and on. So the writer says, what has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. So there's such a finality to life, and yet it's never enough, right? We all keep doing it. We hop on the treadmill again. And I mean, not the literal treadmill, but the treadmill of life. Like, we're going to hop on that again tomorrow, or some of us are going to start our work even this evening, thinking, oh, if I can just get ahead, maybe I can just make progress. And it's just not satisfying. It's empty. We're just going to go after it. It just can't deliver. There's a finality to it, but yet it's never enough. Our world allegedly says to us things like, you define your reality, dig deep, and there's more. But we can't deliver that. We can't deliver that. That new project that you've worked on is going to be replaced by something else to work on. There's something else coming. That great achievement you've had, someone else is going to achieve that. Someone else is going to come along and do it. Think about success that I had, you know, like many of you in high school and college, like in athletics. I mean, I think I still hold my school record in my high school. So, in an event I did. And so, but you know what? Someone's going to break that. I mean, it's not permanent. And if I walked into the high school today, they wouldn't be like, well, Phil's here. This is amazing. They would be like, now who are you again? And what are you doing in our school without the proper ID? You know, why are you here? Because they've long forgotten, right? It's been replaced by something else. There's a weariness to it. The treadmill is being pursued. And again, we think that if we just do more, or if we can last longer, or we can dig deeper, a difference is going to be made. And that will not deliver. Our world is never satisfied. All that has been done has been done. So the preacher comes right out and says, there's nothing new under the sun in verse 9. What has been done is what will be. What has been done is what will be done. And there's nothing new under the sun. So when it comes to life on earth, there's going to be another accomplishment that's going to eclipse yours. Another person is going to have good grades at school and earn a scholarship. And we're going to celebrate that again. Another person is going to have a successful month at work. And they're going to win the Employee of the Month award. Another mom is going to have a better week than you with her kids. And you're going to look at that and go, gosh, I guess I'll try better. There's nothing new under the sun. Vanity of vanities, vanity of vanities. All is vanity. It's all soap bubbles. So, in verses 10 and 11, the preacher digs into this concept of new. And he asks, is there a thing in which it is said, see, this is new? And I know, in our world, because we're a consumeristic society, we can think, well, yeah, of course there's new stuff. You know, so, you know we're rolling jeans now? I lived that. Like a lifetime ago. There's nothing new under the sun. It's already been ages before us. It's just what this is getting at is not that there's no new products in the world, but that there's nothing new in the sense of it's just a poetic way of showing how we feel, of how we're not satisfied. That it's not new in the sense of, like, there's nothing really at its core that is innovative. It's just another variation of something that's already been done. Here's another illustration. Go buy a new car and drive it off the lot and then come back a month later and say, well, it's new. What's going to happen? The answer is going to be, no, it's not. Or the new technological advancement in 6 months is going to be obsolete and there's another new thing that you need to upgrade to. It's never enough. It's never satisfying. There's no remembrance of former things. Nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. So do you remember who played in the Super Bowl 2 years ago? And who won that game? And what was the score? I mean, do you see it's like, oh man, I should know that. Like I was there. Like I devoted my whole weekend to prepping for that. And I can't remember anything about it. Life repeats and things quickly fade like a vapor. There's nothing new under the sun. Life is filled with vanity and enigma. All that work, all that labor, all that toil fails to deliver. There doesn't seem to be much advantage. Our work on earth leaves us empty because there's nothing new in our human world. And so all the writer's doing here is just establishing that man, there's an emptiness to this. Man, there's a purposelessness to most of what goes on in the world. And the world, the earth is permanent, it's always been around, and even that's just a cycle, right? And then all the work that we're doing, there's nothing innovative there. It's there's nothing new in our human world. If you fell over, someone would quickly replace you. I mean, it's just the nature of how this is. So, I know most of you came to church today not wanting to hear that kind of good news. So where do we end from all this? How do we make sense of this in conclusion? Trying to wrap this up. We've seen two ways that our work on earth leaves us empty. And that is, we follow the pattern of creation and there's nothing new in our human world. There doesn't seem to be much gain at all from our toil in this world, from the work that we're doing under the sun. And the reason why that the writer wants us to get to, but I'm going to give you a shadow of today, is that because this is done without God. That's the issue. If you're going to pursue all this without God, then this is what it's going to be. If you're building your life on something like earthly possessions, there's never going to be a point where you have enough. There's never going to be a point where this delivers. You're not going to find satisfaction in your life apart from God. If you think, well, I'm going to give myself to work and that'll give me satisfaction. It's not. It's not able to deliver. That's what the conclusion the writer is wanting us to get to. When there is no reverence for God before you, there's not going to be any joy in the work. Now, lest you think, man, the writer of Ecclesiastes was so negative. Thank God Jesus was more positive. Well, here's what Jesus said in Matthew 16. And listen to how it relates to verse 1-3. What will it profit them if they gain the whole world but forfeit their life? Or what will they give in return for their life? So Jesus is asking the same question as 1-3, right? What does a man gain from his toil by which he toils under the sun? Jesus is saying, what is it going to profit you? What gain is it if you get the whole world but forsake your soul? He's asking the same thing. What can you give in return for your life? I mean, doesn't the things of eternity, doesn't the ground-based layer matter? So our world calls you away from depending on God to be self-made, to just be men and women who build yourselves and create your own empires, chasing the American dream. And I think the book of Ecclesiastes is here to say, don't fall for that. That's a raw bill of goods. It can't deliver. It's not going to satisfy you. You may give yourself fully to your work, but just work alone can't deliver. A paycheck just can't deliver. It's just a temporary... I mean, just these people who have no money that suddenly win the lottery are broke again, like in 3 years. And how does that happen? Because it's fleeting. It's a vanity. It's empty. It's soap bubbles. So these opening verses in Ecclesiastes are calling you away from this way of living to find fulfillment in God. Creation and the treadmill of life help us see that there's nothing gained from all of our toil under the sun. There's nothing new. There's no gain. So we have to look somewhere else for help. And we find that by looking to God. And so today I just invite you to do that. Look to Him. Your labor must be in Him. One writer said, if our labor is not in the Lord, if our work is apart from God, then we gain nothing. Therefore, Jesus warns us, don't store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven. And that's what I'm inviting you to pursue today. Pursue that treasure in heaven. Look to God. Find meaning. Escape the emptiness of life. Look to Him. Look to Him. And if you're a believer, I mean, you probably knew this at the start. When I said, what profit is there to your toil? You probably said, well, a lot, because I know God. I'm hoping that's the conclusion you had. It's meant to awaken you to real life. The whole idea of building your life, especially your life work, on God is seen throughout the Bible. And in fact, in 1 Corinthians 15:58, this is a great cross-reference to think about, Paul tells the Corinthians to be steadfast, to be immovable, to always be abounding in what? In the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. It's not in vain. So your work in this life, your toil in this life, is meant to be His work, That's what gives it value. It's meant to be His. Be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. It's His work. It's in the Lord that your labor is not vanity. So you need to receive the opening verses of this book as well, this opening message from the preacher as well. You don't need a better attitude. You don't need a better work ethic. You don't necessarily need a nicer mojo as you go about the things that you do like all the other rest of the world does. What you need is God. You need to let that work be in Him. So whether it's school and the humdrum of schoolwork and you're thinking, well, I just need to be like these other students in my class that really do it well. No, you need to work as if the Lord was doing that work through you. That's how you need to study. That's how you need to pursue your work. You need God. He's given you work. So let your work be in Him. And that's the case for all of us who are employees or working or whatever toil it is we're doing in this world. You could be a stay-at-home mom doing this toil. You could be retired and doing that toil of what you're doing. But our toil is meant to be in the Lord. Your need is God. He's given you work, and so let your work be in Him. It ought to be the case that for us, to work is Christ, and to die is gain. So, yes, to live is Christ, to die is gain. But in this case, to toil, to work, that's what the advantage is. It's Christ. Because it's in Him. In the Lord, your work is not in vain. So part of the reason we get so weary, no matter what work we do, is because our work is not in the Lord. It's in ourselves. And we're just trying to work to earn another buck. Or we're trying to work to earn the favor of others. But our work is meant to be in the Lord. So I think that's the orientation that the writer is going after here as well. And so that's the challenge for us. Let's run to God. Let's seek Him. Let's put our faith in Him. The language of Ecclesiastes is going to be fear Him. Fear Him. Let's relate to Him rightly, that we might be a people who glorify and enjoy Him forever.